To episode 35 of Redesigning Cities, the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech. Our topic today is redesigning cities' public spaces. I'm your host, Ellen Dunham-Jones, professor and director of the MS in Urban Design at Georgia Tech. I'm very pleased to have a conversation today with Gil Penalosa. Gil has been sharing lessons from his extremely impactful and innovative leadership in public investment in parks, bikeways, and social infrastructure as commissioner in his hometown of Bogota, Colombia. But he's been sharing those lessons with over 350 other cities around the world. After receiving death threats from some unhappy with his focus on equity and democracy, he moved to Toronto, where he runs his nonprofit 8 to 80, his free webinar series, Cities for Everyone, and where he again changed the conversation about public space when he came in second running for mayor. So welcome, Gil. And please correct me. What did I miss? Did I introduce you accurately?
Just to clarify that it's not 8 to 80, but it's 8 and 80.
8 and 80.
Because sometimes people say, but I have a 4-year-old. So I say, no. It's, or my mom is 83. So I say, no, it's 8 and 80 as indicators.
Thank you.
Basically it's a simple but powerful concept. It's what if everything that we did in our cities, the crosswalk, the sidewalk, the park, the school, the library, the restaurant, the coffee shops, everything had to be great for an 8-year-old and for an 80-year-old as indicators.
Yeah.
Because if it's good for the 8 and the 80, it's going to be good for everybody from 0 to over 100. And it's a call to action to stop building cities as if everyone was 30-year-old and athletic.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that clarification. Well, I want to sort of start with basic, let's go back to sort of some general topics about what is public and versus private. I mean, one way to describe the history of civilization is as the pursuit of privacy. Most cultures assume that the point of gaining wealth is to gain more private space and security from others. And we see, I think, around the world, some cities we find immaculate private interiors, high income or not, but either dirty, rundown public spaces or public spaces that from the get-go were just designed for utilitarian functions and ease of maintenance rather than for people. So you've devoted your life to improving public space. Why? And is publicness more important than ever?
Oh, I think by far, in many, many ways. One is because I think an ideal city is where I wanna sleep at home, but I wanna live outside. The public space is kind of like an equalizer also. It belongs to everybody, rich and poor and young and old and everyone. So at the end of the day, people end up spending almost more time in the public space than in the private one, except when people are sleeping. So the public space become very, very relevant. It's everybody uses the public space to go anywhere. So I think that also when we're thinking about climate change and equity and sustainability and all of these key elements, I think public space becomes very important. And I mean, it's so critical that even when you look at the neighborhoods around the world where the wealthy people live, they have magnificent public spaces. Why are we gonna think that only the wealthy people like public spaces with trees, with parks, with sidewalks, with crosswalks, with low speed, and in the low-income areas, people don't want that? Everybody does want much better public spaces.
And not only do they want it, but I think you made a point last night, and I was so happy that you came and spoke to my class, thank you, that it was particularly important to focus investment in the low-income areas, precisely because folks who are poor have so little private space, they really are often even more forced to only sleep at home and really spend a lot more time outdoors.
Exactly. Sometimes the people when the poor people really feel miserable is in the leisure time, Because when people are working, the CEO of a corporation or the minimum wage worker clean the floors, they have a similar experience. But when they have a leisure time, maybe even the CEO has more anxiety. But in the leisure time, the CEO has restaurants and theater and country clubs and travels and whatever. The minimum wage worker doesn't. So if we improve the use of the leisure time, we're going to really improve the quality of life. So really everything public has to be even better in the low-income areas, the sidewalk, the crosswalk, the bike lane, the connectivity to parks, connectivity to public transit, to schools. And unfortunately, a lot of the low-income areas in most cities around the world, the public space is not very good. It's quite poor. And even from the point of view of nature, when you fly over cities, you can almost say where the wealthy people live and the poor people live by the quantity of trees and parks and green areas. So I think that it's something that is necessary for all, and it's really a great equalizer. So that it doesn't matter if you live on a house of 3,000 square feet or 300, but everybody could have the same sidewalk and the same bike lane and the same park and tree and school and library, then it would not make such a huge difference for the people living in the 300 as to the people living in the 3,000.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, absolutely. I think it's also, as we spend more and more time online, we spend more and more time not even just living in the house, we're really practically living on screen. And we're both those differences between who has access to what and how we really get people to come out and be healthy outdoors. I mean, the health aspects, I think so often the disparities, again, between rich and poor people and their health.
Yeah, it's incredible because everybody assumes that public space and parks and sidewalks were good for physical health, but it's also for mental health, for emotional health. Of course, COVID was horrible, but one of the few positive things that came out is that people realized that mental health came out of the closet. People were openly talking about mental health. Two, that people realized that being close to nature was good for mental health. So that if you walked, it was good, but if you walked near nature, it was even better. And there are many studies on many topics. For example, the other day I read a study that in China, about 80% of the children, 5-year-old, they're starting to wear glasses. And they're wearing glasses because they're looking at their screens all the time. But something that came out very interesting is that if the children also spend time outdoors, then half of them will not need glasses. And people say, oh, but what if I have a big living room? They said, it's not enough. But when the kids are outside and then they can see far away, they can see the trees and they can see the clouds and birds and things far away, then the eye adjusts to the time they're on the screen looking just a few inches away from their eyes, that when they are outside, and then their eye doesn't get distorted. So even things like that improve.
Yeah, no, it's so important. Well, the public spaces that you and your brother Enrique, who became mayor after your term as commissioner, the spaces you invested in include social infrastructure, schools and libraries, over 200 parks, which is astonishing, and growth of the Open Streets program, Ciclovía. Tell our audience a bit more about Ciclovía. You know, what is it?
When I was commissioner, I led the construction of over 200 parks, and we designed many, many more. Then when my brother became mayor, he was mayor 2 terms and built over 1,000 parks. It's huge. And basically it's because of valuing this. If you're gonna spend the money of the city doing highways and flyovers and widening and whatever, then you don't have money for other things. So you need to choose. And then if you think that parks are important, then you do parks. In the case of Ciclovía, it's something that is interesting. I love it because every city could have it. I was inspired by Frederick Olmsted. When I became commissioner, I was reading his biography. And Olmsted did most of the large parks in North America, the Emerald Necklace in Boston and Central Park. When he was doing Central Park, he said in New York, everybody hated everybody. the locals and the immigrants, the blacks and the white, the rich and the poor. And he said, they don't know each other. They don't live in the same building. Their children don't go to the same school. They don't even go to the same restaurants. We need people to meet as equals. And then I said, well, maybe any city in the world could have this impact, even if they don't have the park, using the streets. The streets are public space. And there was a small program of a few miles and a few thousand people. And I turned it into the world's largest pop-up park. Every Sunday, over 75 miles of streets are open to people to walk and bike and run and skate and chat and socialize. More than anything, people enjoy the presence of each other. And this has become like a positive virus around the world. Over 500 cities are doing it. And this is great because any city can do it. And the benefits, this is not just fun and games. I mean, fun and games is very important, but it's also good for the environment. For example, we measure the quality of the air at 2 p.m. during open streets. And then in the same place on a weekday, is completely different. The sound, the level of the sound, all of a sudden you're in the middle of the street and you are talking as if you were indoors. It's amazing. While on a weekday, you need to scream for someone to hear you. And then it's also fantastic for issues like loneliness. People want to be with other people. Humans, we are like social animals. We go to a restaurant and if it's empty, we don't want to be there. We want to go to a restaurant with people. We go to the concerts. It's not for the music. It's because we want to be with people. We could listen to that music much better at home or on the phone, but we want to be with other people. So in these open streets, like in the case of Bogota, we get over 1 million people every Sunday of the year and holidays. If it's sunny, we get like 1.8 million people, 1 out of 5 people. The nice thing about this is that any city can do it. All you need is if you have streets and people, you can do it. And it works in cities of 100,000 people, of 1 million, of 10 million. And it has so many benefits. One is letting everybody know that the streets are public space and that they can have different uses according to the time of the day or the day of the week or the week of the year. Also, so it's a public space. Also, it's good for social integration. It's also because people, everybody meets each other as equals. So it has a lot of benefits and any city, anywhere, they can do it.
I love the what this, you know, the idea of the space where you meet as equals. I mean, and how that really is what we want to believe democracy
exactly.
Is about.
Yeah, when you think about it, almost in any city in the world that has this regular program, and I call it regular program because it's not an event. Some cities, including Atlanta, sometimes they do it once a year. No, the events that are once a year, like on 4th of July or New Year's, they usually don't have the impact. They're very, very expensive. They throw in a lot of money and they don't have an impact on health and on other things. It has to be weekly or daily or whatever. So I think these programs are better than events. But on this, feeling as equals, like that CEO of the corporation and his or her minimum wage worker cleaning floors, they never meet as equals except in the open streets. At work, they see each other, but one is the CEO or the owner, and the other one is cleaning floors. But when they're in the open street or ciclovia, bicycles do not differentiate. So if you know about bicycles, you know that the one went by and this cost $5,000 and the other one $50, or one is running with shoes $300 and the other one with $30. But it doesn't matter because it doesn't differentiate. So it is really wonderful because it's all ages and abilities and ethnicities. Like, and it's great because like, this is not like a marathon, because in a marathon, you shut down the city and the intersections here. No, when there the light goes red, it stops and the car, people on cars can cross or whatever. The other is that you don't need to be in shape. You can go out and you walk for 10 minutes and then rest. And then on average, people usually stay over 4 hours. But on average, they do about 15 minutes of activity. So they run for 20 minutes, then they stop. People want to watch other people. So it's something that really truly is for people of all ages, people with disabilities, all of the sudden people that are on wheelchairs, or people that are blind and that are completely scared, terrified of going out on the streets because of the cars. Now they got the streets all for themselves. The children, I think that the modern day wolf are the cars. You tell a child, hey, watch out, a car is coming. And the child jumps frightened. And they should, because the drivers are killing too many children. And all of a sudden now they have this street for themselves. They can walk around. So I think that is it's something kind of magical. I think that when people go to Disney World, for example, I think that more than the attraction themselves, the kids enjoy that is a car-free city. They can run all over the place. They can run. The parents don't need to be concerned about them. And so I think the open streets is really good. And people of all religions and ethnicities and backgrounds. And I think that helps us be better, because sometimes people live segregated in some neighborhoods that they never get to meet people of another religion or another ethnicity or another. And so this is useful.
Absolutely. Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think, it's interesting. It's sort of also turning them into third places, where I love Ray Oldenburg's, one of his descriptions of a third place. If, home's the first place, work's the second. The third place is where the hierarchies of the first two no longer apply. It's truly just everyone is equal. And
exactly. No one is mentioned if you are smart or not, if you are good looking or not. Nothing. Also, because we need to create cities where people, regardless of their background, I mean, some children were not fortunate. Maybe they lived in a neighborhood where the schools were very bad, or their parents didn't have any education. Some didn't even know who their parents were, or whatever. And then they also deserve to live a life at the fullest possible level of health and happiness. So we need to create those opportunities that no one is judging, no one, and everybody can be. You can have the person doing the PhD at Georgia Tech, or you can do also the one that is homeless, and both are just as happy, and both are walking on the same open street. So that is a feeling that all of us said, this is our city.
I mean, part of what I find so attractive about, I haven't visited, so I haven't seen Ciclovia in Colombia, but is, the videos of people doing hula hoops or doing the different kind of aerobic, kind of dancing all together as groups. How exactly, and because that piece is what I haven't really seen in the Atlanta versions I've participated in, where there will be a series of booths with information and help, especially on health, frankly, along the sides of the street. But how exactly do you really, you manage to grow it into more than just, okay, the streets are closed to cars, you can come out and bike. It's a lot more than that. How
much
did you
more.
Make it so much more
yeah.
fun?
Yeah, one thing is to tell people it's not about cycling. Actually, that's the only bad thing of the one in Bogota is that it's called Ciclovia, so it has kind of a cycling. No, it's not about cycling. So I tell cities, please don't put another name. Like in Guadalajara, we have a really good name that is Recreative Street. So it's about recreation and activity. In Paris is Paris Respire, Paris Breathes. So having a different name, I think, not really. 65% of the people are going to bike. So you're going to get the cyclists no matter what. You don't need to put the name on it to have cyclists. The other 35% are going to walk or run or skate or just go out and chat and socialize and be with other people. So that's important. The real magic are the streets. So that you see it with cars and all of a sudden you can use it. So that is the main magic. As a complement, something that works is along the way in public spaces, invite private sector companies to do activities. So Lululemon can sponsor and they do aerobics or they do yoga. And then in other places, people do, or the government organizes hula hoops or games that are inexpensive, that are traditional, that anybody can do, or also music. Some people come out and play music. So it's a little bit about a cultural experience, and people love it. Also, something that works very well is health, because there are some places, what we did in Bogota, and I've been promoting the same in many cities, is please, people are totally relaxed. They have time. So let's have some health stations where people can weight themselves and enter the computer. So if they wait a month later, they can know, and they can know if the weight went up or down. But also they can advise. They can advise on nutrition. They can advise on how to stretch, or the level, what they should be doing in between from one Sunday to the following. So it's also a wonderful place to provide advice. I saw in San Francisco, they were doing some on the ground with gigantic maps, and they were doing citizen engagement, asking people about where they wanted to do trails and where they wanted to do parks. So now people that would never go to a public meeting, they are there, they have the time, and actually they get curious. What is this map? Or, oh, this is our city. What are you doing? Oh, we're thinking whether to do these trails or this. And we're getting input from the citizens. So people stop and they can even walk on top of the map or whatever and provide input. So also some areas are blocked only for small children. So to teach small children how to ride bicycles. So it has a lot of multiplying effects. In Portland, I saw an area where they were teaching older people how to ride tricycles and also how to ride e-trikes. So because many people had never ridden a bicycle, I said, no worries, now you can ride a tricycle, it's okay. And then if it's a little bit hilly, well, now there are e-tricycles. So it's a safe environment for people to do it. So it could have endless benefits. And I think something that I love is that it's free. Everybody can participate, and it's non-commercial. I mean, people might sell juice or fruits or things, but it's micro people. It's even children, they come out with lemonade and they sell the lemonade or whatever. But it's about anybody.
Yeah. No, it's fabulous, and we need more. It's also streets are the connectors, and so connecting those neighborhoods and.
Exactly.
Welcoming people into neighborhoods that aren't usually going into.
That was part of my obsession. When I became commissioner, there were only a few miles, and most of it in the upper income areas of the city. And I said, no, we got to connect the city as one. So the poorest, the slums, I wanted to connect the slums, and it was very clear. And it's very interesting. For example, cities like Guadalajara, half of the city is divided by a big avenue, and in one side is the white upper class, and the other side is more the low income of Indian descent. And they began with 12 kilometers, so about 8 miles. And 4 miles was on one side and the other four on the other. Initially, the first Sunday, they would only go to that street and go back. Then they started crossing a little bit. By the third Sunday, they were mixing and whatever. And it was everybody. So that is something that is really nice. I remember an old woman that knew that I helped create it, and then she was hugging me, and she said, thank you. And I said, but why are you so happy? She said, because my grandchildren, before on a Sunday, either they were sleeping or they were drinking beer or watching television. Now they get up really early because they want to go, because their girlfriends, their boyfriends, whatever, everybody is out and they want to be. And those are things that would never happen. It's in Guadalajara, it's a very successful one. They began only with 8 miles, and now they are doing about 40 miles, and they are having about 400,000 people. And some people say, what would all these 400,000 people be doing on a Sunday if there was not this operation? And it's great for business. The businesses do very well. Initially, everywhere the business is opposed. Oh, this is going to be bad. No, then they love it because they do a lot of sales. Also, they watch a lot of people. Like all of a sudden, they got a store, and you say, well, we have 400,000 people in Guadalajara when they never knew that you even existed. They're coming from other neighborhoods, and they're going slow. They're walking. They're cycling. So they see things. In San Francisco, I saw a sign on a store of a furniture that was really funny. It said, washrooms, free washrooms. And I said, washrooms? And then I went in, I said, what is it? I said, can I speak to the manager? And he said, oh, I'm the owner. And I said, why do you have free washroom? I said, because we always ask people, where did they learn about us? And when San Francisco started doing their open streets, we started seeing a lot of people that would come on the weekdays. And when we asked them, they said, oh, it wasn't the open streets. So he said, our washrooms are on the back of the store. So to go to the washroom, they need to go by and they see. Of course, they're not going to have a sofa and take it on the bicycle. But they come back a week later, 2 weeks later, and they buy it, and they're over there. So we have some watchmen who have a really beautiful, very nice kept, and people go. Also, in some places, the restaurants used to open only for lunch and dinner on Sundays. Now, it multiplies by 10, the ones that open for breakfast, because people are on their bike or they stop and they to get a juice or something. It's also good for business. Of course, change is hard. So initially, there might be opposition. But you're going to say, okay. The other beauty of this is that it's very low risk. All you need really is people and streets, so low cost. And the level of risk, you are not building arenas or gymnasiums. So you can tell people, look, let's do it next year. Let's do it the first Sunday of every month. So let's do 12 to start. If it doesn't work, okay, then the following year we don't do it. But if it works, the following year we do it weekly. And then, so it's, people are much more open when you say, okay, we're going. Also because the retail, they see, something that happened in San Francisco was interesting because a lot of the retail and the Chamber of Commerce didn't want it. And then the first Sunday, they sold more than any other Sunday. They said, oh, maybe it's a fluke, let's wait. The next one, again, they sold more. So then they went to the city and said, please don't do it once a month. We want you to do it every Sunday because we are selling more when there is open streets. And also new clients, because it's people that they didn't even know that these other stores existed. So, and it's good for everybody. So you see people on wheelchairs and people that are blind and people with walkers and babies, parents and babies and things. So those are the kind of things that are equalizers, that make us feel more like human beings. So, because the other beauty is that, I mean, of course, I love parks. I built hundreds of parks, but especially the small neighborhood parks are very, very important because you develop a sense of belonging. You meet your neighbors. That also gives more safety because if I know my neighbors and something is happening out, I go out and help. If I don't know anybody, I stay inside. But people are very homogeneous because the people that go to the neighborhood park are the people that live around the park. So they might be all the same ethnicity or the same race or the same level of education. When you are interconnecting the city with this, then you have a whole mix. You really get to see who are the people that are living in the city.
Well, and I think you also, getting back to Ciclovia on this, I mean, that helping people imagine that actually they don't need a car all the time. And to see that impact of the change of the car, and to just see your city differently. I thought it was fascinating. I got to go to Paris 2 summers ago at once the e-bikes and the bikes were around. I had been to Paris many times before. We used to have a program there, part of Georgia Tech. And I always got around by subway. So in my head, my map of Paris, a mental map, was a pretty good map. But I just assumed, okay, yeah, that station stop is pretty far from that station stop on the map. And yet you get on a bike and you go, oh, they're right next to each other. The city shrank for me the minute I got onto a bike. Even though, yeah, and also I'd taken taxis or whatever, you know, I mean, I spent plenty of time on the surface streets, but when you bike it, you realize it's not that far. Things are not as far apart.
Exactly.
As we think they are.
Yeah, there are two enormous benefits from the point of mobility that you just touched. One is that people realize things are a lot closer. All of a sudden, because many of the people, this is not a war on the car, or it's not bikes versus car, no. Because many of the people using the open streets, they have cars. On the weekend, they're using their car. But on Sunday, they come with their children, their parents, their partner, whoever, and they use it. And they say, oh my God. If it was safe to bike, I could bike to work once in a while. And then, because they realized that it was only 10 minutes or 15 or 20, or whatever, and they said, oh, and it's fun, I get the wind, I see people, I can stop for coffee, whatever. So people realize that the cities are a shorter distance than what it was. The other thing that I thought interesting that you mentioned is the subway. When you're on the subway below ground, you don't see anything. You only see the stations. And sometimes people have this erroneous, like in Toronto, they were going to do a light rail above ground. And then it was fully designed, fully costed, everything to be above ground. And a couple of years ago, the premier, that is the current, the governor of the province, said, oh, what if we do it? What if we put this underground? It's only going to cost $2.4 billion. I said, what? $2.4 billion? It's going to be the same train, the same speed, fewer stations because it was so expensive. And I said, ask people. We should ask people things, for example, on mobility, for happiness. And ask people, if you could go at the same or similar speed, above ground or below ground, what would you choose? Above ground, watching other people, the sun, the trees, the stores, the retail, or below ground, dark. I would say that 9 out of 10 people would prefer to go above ground, and 9 out of 10 rats would prefer to go underground. So those are the things that also we need to think. But then many of those engineers that are designing, they drive cars and they think that if they send the people, the other people, they send them underground, they're going to have more space for their cars. No, there's no city in the world the size of Atlanta that has sole mobility to the private car. None. So we need to look at all options. And if people are going to be healthier and happier going above ground, let's have them above ground. Oh, do we need to restrict car use? Probably yes. But are they going to live better? Yes. Also for the stores. But one thing that was incredible is that some of the retail supported the premier on putting it underground. And I said, are you going crazy? You're going to have 50, 60, 80,000 people going by in front of your store, just daydreaming, looking out the window. And you want them to go underground. They're not going to see anybody, just the station. Then they go underground. They come out the other station. So I think that's also interesting for people. And by the way, if the people that use public transit is good for climate change, is good for the quality of the air, is good for everything, why do we send them underground? Why don't we send the cars underground and not the public transit? We should give the people that use mobility that is good for the common public, the common good, the walker, the cyclist, the public transit, the best conditions, safe and enjoyable, and not punish them going underground.
I want to invite our audience members, if you have any questions, please post them in Q&A. And we will we'll try to get to them. We've got certainly a few more minutes. Anu, do we have any Q&A so far?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll get to the Q&A soon. But let's talk a little bit, Gil, about who all these spaces are for, and your nonprofit, 8 and 80, and sort of the I think you've talked about the importance of health, the importance of fun, but let's talk a little bit about how cities have to start competing with each other to be more fun and more healthy.
That's a very important point, because before, people went to cities because they wanted to work, and people did even crazy things, like some genius people invented something and created Dow Chemical in the middle of a town of 10,000 people, and their workers, they would come from all over the world and live there for 40 years till they retire in a town where there was nothing, one movie theater and now no one would go and live in the town of 10,000 people with nothing to do. Not because it's a small. I think that small communities also, they need to get better. But what is interesting is that even now with hybrid work, more and more the cities are going to be places of fun. They need to be playful. And they are going to be the ones that are going to be successful. People will want to live there. Something that is interesting is that today, the people that are good at anything, if you are a good teacher or nurse, or if you are good making pizza or coffee, whatever, you can work anywhere in the world. So cities need to think, okay, why would they live in Atlanta? Why would they live in Toronto, where I live? Why would they live anywhere in the world? So I think one of the biggest challenges for city leaders, from the public, private NGOs, is how to create cities that retain people, that attract people, because where people live if they're not having fun, if it's not good. So when we're talking about the trees and the bike lanes and the events and the programs and the activities and the four seasons and all of this, it's because we want to retain people. We want to attract. And are you attracting the cream of the crop or are you attracting the leftovers? So cities to be competitive, it's about that. Many cities, I hear many cities that are small and they say, oh, but all the young people are living, oh, that's natural because they like the big city. No, they are living because your city is boring. Just because it's small, it doesn't have to be boring. Small cities could be amazing, could be fantastic. Actually, it's a lot easier to do a network for cycling in a city of 100,000 people than in a city of 10 million people. But they gotta do it. It's not just because they are small that they are good. They can be small and horrible, or they can be small and great. So make that city if you want to retain or if you want to attract people. So I think that's something, and it's anywhere in the world. That's what Paris, for example, now the current mayor in the last 5 years, she says she wanted everybody in Paris to have a protected bike lane within 3/4 of a mile, within 1 kilometer. And she is doing it. She said she was going to do it in 5 years. And she's doing it. It's not because she's crazy. It's not because she doesn't know what to do with the money. Of course, she also has a lot of money restrictions. No, it's because she wants to retain the people. She wants to attract people. She doesn't want them to go to Georgia Tech and get a great education and then say, oh, I want to live anywhere but here. No, they want to say, no, I want to live here. I want to go to school here, and I want to live here. I want to have my family here. And that's why these cities, because Paris knows that Paris is competing with Atlanta and with Toronto and with Copenhagen and with everyone. How to attract and how to retain the best teachers for the university, the nurses for the hospital, the musicians. They want to go to a pizza place and have a good pizza, so then they're going to have the good business people. So this is something that quality of life has become probably the most important tool of economic competitiveness. I mean, 200 years ago, what made cities powerful was land. So cities would take over the next one and have land. Last century, maybe, was capital, so people could live. But now is quite a city that is fun, that is playful, where people are going to live happier and healthier, and there's equity. And also because this is a competitive advantage that is very, very hard for someone to imitate. So, for example, if someone goes to a city, I shouldn't give names of cities, but I said if someone goes to Boston and someone goes to Houston, and then you want to set up a business, and then Boston says, oh, I'll give you $1 million subsidy, and then they go to Houston, oh, I'll give you $1.5 million. Now people are not setting up just because of the subsidies. These people say, oh, where am I gonna be able to attract the best workers, the best talent? Where are they gonna live happier? Even if I pay them more, are they gonna work 2 years and then leave, or are they gonna stay? So the wonderful thing is that if you have a good city that is fun and exciting and safe and good quality of life, and another one that is not, they cannot say, oh, then like writing a check of subsidy, I give you more. No, it takes years and years and years. So if you have invested in creating a good city for everyone, that will give you an economic advantage, an enormous economic advantage over cities that have not. Because yeah, if they say, oh, no, war is company, I'll fix, I'll become good. Okay, but it's going to take you 10 or 20 years to become good. So those are the cities that are going to be getting the best university professors and also the best students and the best workers and the best this. So it's about really survival. And when we're talking about retaining people and attracting, also is because the countries, the population is decreasing. So we are increasing the population in cities because it's still there's a lot of children and youth, but little by little, the population is leveling off. And most countries, like the top 30 countries, developed countries, all of them, the population is decreasing. We are having more people dying than people that are being born. The only reason to increase is because of immigration, but sooner or later it's gonna decrease. So the competition for people is gonna be enormous. I mean, it's already happening. People go to one university to another. The other day I had a professor that from Texas, and I won't say the city, just the state. And he said that he had been offered jobs to teach the same courses at two other universities. And he said, I didn't even think about it. And they were paying him 10 and 12% more. And he said, but last month I got an offer from Portland State University. Not more salary, the same salary. And I'm waking up in the middle of the night because I don't know if the right decision is to stay here where I've been living for 10, 12 years, or if I should move. So that's where good cities, Portland is a city that is walkable, that is bikeable also, that it has a lot of green spaces and whatever. And that has a competitive advantage that is more important than 10 or 12% more salary.
Absolutely. You know, Gil, you're so good at, your passion comes through immediately in these conversations, and you're so good at inspiring others. And with your fantastic photographs that help tell the story so well. So I really do want to encourage listeners, check out the videos as well, the webinars. What advice do you have for those in our audience who would like to become passionate advocates for their cities, but don't know how to? How did you become an advocate? How does anyone become an advocate?
Well, I've been fortunate to have worked in more than 350 cities all over the world in our continents. And one of the things that I noticed is that cities do change. Many cities change. I mean, Melbourne 30 years ago would not have been in the top 300 cities in the world. No one, even the people in Melbourne didn't want to live in Melbourne. It was the typical donut city where people would come from the suburbs, work, and then leave. And today, Melbourne, in every ranking, is in the top 5 cities, but they changed. All of this, they made it walkable, they created bike lanes, they put trees. The street didn't have any trees. Now they got lots of trees. And in the summertime, in Melbourne, might be 110 degrees, 115. But with the trees, they lower the temperature up to 20 degrees.
And I love the laneways, what they did with their alleys.
Oh, it's magnificent. They have some laneways that were dark and dirty and smelly, and they have transformed either restaurants or art or all kinds of things, 84 of them so far. So it's so cities do change. And I think that also city building is not just for urban planners. It's for everybody. I think that we need a lot more mix. Sometimes when I work or go to the cities, I'm surprised that the people in the urban planning don't talk to transportation and transportation to parks and parks to environment and environment with public health and whatever. And then I go to the universities and the same thing happens. No one talks to each other, even though they are on the same campus and they are not talking to each other. We need cities should be about everybody. If you are a dentist, if you are a lawyer, as a way of giving back, I do a webinar every other Tuesday at 11 a.m. It's always free, and I try that. That is always interesting. And most people are not urban planners. And I'm lucky that I always have people from over 40 countries, hundreds of people registering. But the cities really, this has more of an impact. I'm curious that people pay more attention to the elections at the national level than at the city level. When the city level is either if they have park or not. I mean, the U.S. is the wealthiest country in the world. And 1 out of 3 persons living in a city on urban do not have a park within walking distance. It's totally crazy. And now some organizations are developing campaigns to have it by 2050. I said, why 2050? It's not for the children of today's children or their grandchildren. No, why don't we do it by 2030? It's totally doable. So the sidewalk, the park, the walkability, the safety, all of this, everything that you have to deal with city issues every day in your daily activity. So let's improve it. So I do think that for whatever reason, if you like public health, because this has to do with mental and physical health, if you don't care about that, but you like climate change, it's about the environment. If you don't care about that, but you have a small business and it's about the money, this is about the money. This is about how can you make small local businesses thrive. So we need to engage the citizens.
All right, we have some questions. We have a question from Ann Daigle. A study by UN Women found 60% of women globally feel unsafe in public space. 60%. This feeling is the same in the US as it is in Africa. What would be your recommendations for changing that? It's a great topic and question. I'm also interested.
Well, have more women.
Yeah.
You know, that's very important. One of the important indicators of public places is if it has more women than men. And she's totally right. That is a key element. And we need to do two things. One is we need to have safer places, and we need people to feel safe. It's different. Some places are safe, but you don't feel safe. Others you feel safe, but they're not as safe. But that is very important. A park, for example, a park that is very, very well managed in New York, Bryant Park, they count people twice a day, not once a year, twice a day they count, and they have a management committee every Monday. And if at any time there were fewer women than men, then it's like a red flag. They say, what were we doing wrong? What was happening at that moment? So, and I think something that is important for public places is that what makes them safe is to have more people. And for example, sometimes I go to the cities and it seems easier to find $1 million to do a park than a few thousand to make it work. But we need to have those few thousand for the programs, for people to have walking groups and knitting groups and all kinds of activities in groups. When there's a lot of people in the public place, you need very little police. When they are empty, you need a lot of police. So that is one of the elements. And also we need to have a gender-based approach. When I was saying that 880 cities is about making cities for everyone, because the cities is not just for the 30-year-old and athletic and men on cities designed by men. No, we need to have the women. Also because women have different patterns. For example, from the point of view of mobility, men go from their house to the place of work. Women do a lot of other trips in between. So hopefully someday both will be doing trips in between, because he's getting milk and eggs and dropping the children at school or whatever. So we need to have a gender-based approach, but it's very, very important. I think any public place where you have fewer women than men, or substantially fewer, there is something wrong. Yeah. There is something wrong.
I'm very impressed with the EU adopted gender mainstreaming guidelines in 1998. Mm-hmm. And the work that at Vienna, Amsterdam, Stockholm, I mean, there's some really impressive, some of it's not always rocket science, because some of it's not just about the feeling of safety. It's just, you know, literally, can you push a baby carriage on that sidewalk, get it on the bus, get it, you know, I mean, some of them are very super practical, or just enough lighting. So great question.
And I'll give you an example. For example, cycling. I love Piedmont Park, and I also like the Beltline. When you go there on the Sundays, you probably see more women cycling than men. But when you go to the bike lanes of the city that are not safe, you see many, many more men than women. Women are smarter, and they don't want to risk their life. They want to take care of it. So women is an indicator. The cities that are safe for cycling, for example, in Copenhagen, there is more women cycling than men. So any city that has a network of protected bikeways, you have more women than men cycling. When you don't, you have many, many more men than women cycling. So that is also an indicator.
Absolutely. All right. One more question from Mike Messner at the Speedwell Foundation. Have you seen impacts on crime and health in the cities you worked with that have embraced more parks?
Lots, huge. Let me give you an example. In Bogota, one of my brothers was mayor from 2016 to 2020. He said he was gonna put lights in 1,000 parks. Actually, he ended up putting 1,164. And what is interesting is that after he left, so he had nothing to do with the story. After he left, the National Police and the best university in the country together did a study of the impact on the parks that they put lights. And what was very interesting is that not only the park, but four or five blocks around the park became much safer, much safer. Fewer consumption of drugs, fewer selling drugs, fewer gangs, fewer any type of incident of crime. And so it's amazing. Now, many, many cities in the country and in other places, they are taking this study and they are starting to put lights. And it makes a lot of sense, because when those parks were dark at night with no activity, then they were like fertile grounds for bad behavior, for people selling drugs or consuming or whatever. Now, with lots of light and doing activities, they became community hubs. So not only someone is going to go and play, but the boyfriend or the girlfriend or the parents or the grandparents, people start. So there is activity. So when there is people, there's a lot less crime. So yeah, it's very, very evident. Also, but those parks need to have activity. So we need to have programs, all kinds of programs for all ages, for children 0 to 4, also for older people. Older people is we really gotta have cities that are much better for older people. Let's say sometimes cities say, oh, but we do activities for adults and they don't sign up. I say, no, it's very different adults than older adults. Because if you are 40, you don't have time. I mean, we sleep 8 hours. We work 8 hours. So we have another 8 hours. Of those 8 hours, maybe two or three are commuting, and then we have only five, and then we gotta cook and things. So we only got like 2 hours. We're not gonna register for anything for those 2 hours. But you retire, and then all of a sudden it multiplies. Instead of having 2 hours, now you also have the 8 hours of work available and the 2 or 3 hours of commuting. So the people that have the most leisure time are the older adults, but we do not organize activities. We need to, I mean, everybody should care about older adults, because it's your parents, your grandparents, yourself, or if it's your future self, if you are lucky. It's 1/3 of our lives. So programs is something that is very important. And sometimes older people also don't go to they are concerned about safety. So that's why we need to make it safe. I was working in a city in the U.S., a city of more than 1 million people, and I worked with the mayor for about 8 or 10 blocks. And then I said, "Mayor, I haven't seen any bench." And he said, "Gil, it's the homeless." I said, "What?" I said, "There is magic in this city that you take out a bench and a home shows up." I said, "Now the homeless is going to sleep on the sidewalk, not on the bench." But people with disabilities, children, youth, especially the older people, they will not walk because they need to have those benches. Also, that's part of the safety. So the sidewalks are almost more the family of the parks than the family of the streets. Because on the street, on bicycle, on cars, on public transit, we're going from point A to point B. Not on sidewalk. The sidewalk, I say, is almost the most important infrastructure in the cities where people meet boyfriends and girlfriends. We meet neighbors, the people selling fruits and flowers and coffee and whatever. I mean, we go to any city, we leave a backpack and we go out walking. So it's the sidewalks where we develop that sense of belonging. But that's when the sidewalks, they also need to be safe and feel safe. They need to be clean. They need to have garbage, and they need to have benches and trees and lights and safe crosswalks. And one of the things, Ellen, when you were saying about enthusiasm, is because this is doable anywhere, in any city. This is not a technical issue. Also, we have a lot of good practices that can be done. Also, it's not a financial issue. It's very inexpensive to do infrastructure for people walking or cycling or to do parks or trees as compared to widening highways or doing flyovers. So this is not a technical or financial. This is about policy, not a political party. All political parties should be in favor of this. It doesn't make any sense, for example, that the U.S. has the highest proportion of pedestrians killed by drivers and the highest cyclists killed by drivers proportional. It doesn't make any sense. Why? So basically it's because the cities are not being built that are safe. So I do think that I'm optimistic is because things are doable. We're talking about it. It's doing an analogy with a soccer field. Maybe 20 years ago, no one was talking. So it was like if we were outside of the stadium. Now everybody's talking about these things. So now we're on the field and we're passing the ball around. But we need to remember that if the ball does not cross the line, we don't score goals. And we are not scoring enough goals. We need to score goals. We need to move from talking to doing. And that is the next phase. To do that, we need passionate advocates. And we need not only urban planners and architects. We need dentists and lawyers and the people that flip hamburgers and the people that move the bags at the airport. Everybody to talk about cities. Just an anecdote. Yesterday, I did like a two-hour session at the conference on urban health. When I was picking up my computer, one of the waiters that was cleaning the dining room, he came over and he said, "Oh, thank you." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Oh, I enjoy your talk so much." And he said, "You know, I was so much against density. I hated density. I was one of the people that when they talk about density, but now I understand why we need density. Now, not 40-story buildings, we need 5-story next to each other on the arterials. Because if we don't have 5 stories, then the local store is going to go broke. And my friend's restaurant that is local is going to go broke. And there won't be any local pottery and stores and whatever." So he said, "You changed me in this hour from being an advocate against density to being an advocate for density." So you don't have to have a PhD to understand these topics. This is about everybody. And yeah. I think one of the big issues, I think, is that we have not been good communicating, because the reality is that most of the cities that we have done in the last 50, 70 years in the world, but I mean, I think it's a nice challenge to ask people. Tell me one city that is doing it right in the US or Canada in the last 50 years. Almost none. I think there's a lot of good examples, but like with acupuncture, one neighborhood here, one community center there, one bike lane there. No. So with the US is going to increase by around 80 million people, 100 million people. So the US is going to build up around 50 million homes. What a wonderful opportunity, because if those 50 million homes are done in the right way, also a lot of this sprawl of very low density can be fixed by increasing the density on the arterials and things. But we need to do it right. But we need to say, okay, how do we want to live? I mean, if we want the children, a simple question, if we want children to walk to school, the elementary schools have to be small. If we do gigantic elementary schools, they are not going to be walked to, they're going to be drive to. So these are the kind of things that we need to have a shared vision of how do we want to live, and then action, action, action.
Thank you, Gil. I mean, I think you've given us so many ideas, and hopefully we're going to get even more people listening, because you're a terrific communicator in helping us figure all of this out. And thank you to the attendees. You've been listening to episode 35 of Redesigning Cities, the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech. A podcast of this event will be posted to our website, where you can also check out previous episodes. And for more lessons from Gil and his guests from around the world, go to gpenalosa.ca to watch his Cities for Everyone webinars.
Thank you very much. And also, I ask the people that listen to this, not only to listen, but if you like anything, not mine, many of the others. I have heard many of the podcasts that you have done. I've heard the one that you did with Mitchell Silver about parks and with the other former commissioner of parks in New York, Adrian Benopi. And also, with so many, I love them. Share them. The one that I like, I send it to a lot of friends. So share whatever you like, especially with decision makers, with city staff, with others, because Helen is doing fantastic podcasts, but the more people that listen to them, the better.
Thank you.